Hello and follow Mitch Pakwell, and welcome to EWTN Live. We bring you guests from around the world. And our guest tonight is a very good friend of the network and a good friend of mine. You may have seen her on various shows like Catholic View for Women, or she also appears on our March for Life coverage over the years. And if you listen to EWTN Radio, you've probably heard her show, Catholic Connections, on weekdays at 9 a.m. Eastern Time on EWTN Radio. And she's very kind and invites me to join her on that show every week. She comes to us through Detroit, but her roots are in Italy, and she has taken her experience of going on many trips and pilgrimages to her Italian homeland and putting them into a book designed to help you make the most of a trip to Italy to see the sacred places, cherished saints and their shrines, fantastic sights, especially useful during this Jubilee Year of Hope. Her new book is called Italy's Shrines and Wonders, Discovering Sacred Spaces, Fascinating Places, and Destinations Off the Beaten Path. Please welcome our guest, Teresa Tamio. Teresa.
Good to see you in person.
I know. It's a voice. Yeah. Two voices passing on the phone lines.
Yes. Thank you for having me.
Oh, it's great to have you here. And thank you for writing this book. Your family, you were not born in Italy.
No. My grandparents. I'm second generation Italian.
Yeah. All right. Mm-hmm. But you've now acquired a home over there.
Yeah.
Was that easy to do?
No. I love my Italian people, but the bureaucracy in Italy is quite interesting. But it was such a gift, and my husband, who is also Italian, Domenico, Deacon Dominic, we're both full-blooded FBIs, full-blooded Italians, and loved traveling there and started traveling there almost 25 years ago and just fell in love with it and reconnected with our heritage and our Catholic faith, most importantly. And as he got closer to retirement, it became more and more of a possibility because we were going over there two or three times a year, leading trips, as you said, and we've led dozens of trips in the last 25 years or so. And it just became something that was doable because being on radio, it's the internet, so I can, thanks be to God, do my show from anywhere. And so 2 years ago, we made it a reality and found a little place in central Italy, and now we're there several months a year. So, yeah.
By the way, when you say you can do your radio show anywhere, what has been the oddest place you've done your radio show in?
That's a great question, because I've done it on cruise ships, which is interesting, because you never know what the weather is going to bring. I've done the show from Israel, which was also beautiful, from the Holy Land. Gosh, all over the world. So I would probably say, I would think maybe over in the Holy Land, because we never knew where we were going to end. I've done the show from Italy several times, even on a trip with pilgrims. But you never know where you're going to end up in terms of the time of day. And so with the hours being with 7 hours ahead, right, in the Holy Land, and six in Italy. So we'd always have to go to a place, maybe pull off the road somewhere and pull in and find the internet. So I would say somewhere off the road in the Holy Land, probably the most unique places I've done the show.
Sure.
Yeah.
The trips to Italy, and you've gone there two, three times a year for 20 years.
So it's over 60 times I've been there.
Yeah. Why do you like it so well?
Well, being a revert to the faith, both my husband and I, and really when we came back to the church, the first trip that we made there on an official pilgrimage was with our parish in the Archdiocese of Detroit. It was only a few years after we came back to the church, and then everything really came, I think, full circle for us, both our Catholic faith, most importantly, and our Italian heritage.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a combination of the first and foremost Catholicism, because you cannot, and you know this, you cannot walk one step in Italy. I don't care where you are. The church is there, whether it's in a statue here or a fountain here or in a piazza where there's something dedicated to this particular saint. Everywhere you go, the faith is everywhere. And then the beauty is so unique.
Yeah. See, that's the thing. You know, the church has fashioned all of Italy.
Mm-hmm.
It really has.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's important for people to understand how old Italian culture is. Mm-hmm. It's not Rome. Rome is not that old a city.
Right.
I mean, from the 8th century BC, yeah, it's not so old. But there is culture prior to the founding
the
of Rome.
Right.
The
mm-hmm.
Etruscans. Mm-hmm. And there were a number
right.
of cultures even before the Etruscans.
Right. Right. Mm-hmm.
So there's this long, long history. And you're seeing the ruins of the Etruscans, the Roman Empire, which is all over.
Right.
It's really cool.
It's very cool. And I think it's so, I think, humbling. Because we in our modern age, you know, in the 21st century, think that we're all that in a bag of chips or maybe a bag of cannolis. I don't know, whatever your food preference is. But you really go through even Pompeii, for example, and you see how they laid out the roads. And they used particular stones because those white stones will reflect the moonlight. So as the carriages are coming through, they'll be able to see coming down the street in addition to the torches. They even had walkways, as you know, in Pompeii. Raised areas of the street so people could come across. And we think that we've invented everything, and it's been there. It's like Ecclesiastes, nothing new under the sun,
yeah, yeah.
right? And,
yeah, yeah.
and so it's very humbling. And the other thing too, I think is, and this is my prayer, and this is the main reason I wrote the book, it's stealth evangelization for me. Because who doesn't like Italy, right? I don't care if you're Italian, if you're, you know, Irish, whatever. Everybody wants to go to Italy because it's such a beautiful place. And great food, great wine, in addition to the art, culture, and the faith. And so you can bring people there and show them the beauty without even saying a word. And my hope is that anyone who lines up to see the Pietà in St. Peter's or to go to the Sistine Chapel in the Vatican Museums is that they're not only going to look at the art, but they're going to look at the artist and hopefully the artist who made the artist. Everything
yes.
goes back to God. So
yeah.
that's my goal with this book, is to show them the beauty of Italy. And, you know, Bishop Barron in his beautiful series on Catholicism, where he went around the world and showed the beauty of the faith in churches and shrines. That is my hope with this book, in addition to really being a book for anyone interested in Italy. It could be an armchair pilgrimage. We're doing an online series, a free online series through EWTN on the book, which is coming out in the spring, which was shot on location in Italy. And, you know, it's a great way to go there, even if you can't go. Maybe you have young children, you can't get out yet, but you can certainly learn about this and learn more about your faith, because I really bring the saints home in this book as well.
Yeah, well, that's one of the things there. I think I was starting to say about how, you know, really marvelous it is to see what had been these earlier empires and civilizations, and the Romans really had a number of magnificent things. And yet, the beauty of the Catholic faith mm-hmm. in Italy is not something of just the past. It's an ongoing
right.
presence. And, you know, the fact that Italy became the place where the Renaissance came into its fullness.
Right.
The artistry of Italy was inspired by a combination of the ancient Romans during the Renaissance, but also by the influx of Byzantine refugees
mm-hmm.
after the fall of Constantinople, and this desire for beauty. And so it wasn't only Michelangelo, but Raphael, all these different fantastic artists who are not Ninja Turtles, but they're real guys that made beautiful works.
And it's incredible because you talk about Byzantine. I mean, in whatever area of Italy, Florence is known as a Renaissance city, right? But down in Puglia, you have Lecce, which is considered the Florence of the South, and Puglia is the heel of Italy. But then if you're over on the Adriatic and you're in the Veneto and you go further south to Ravenna, Ravenna is what? The mosaic city, right? The
exactly.
city of mosaics, and you have the Byzantine influence with the icons and everything. Those
yes.
churches are amazing. And it's everywhere. And I can remember I was sitting in our home in Italy last year finishing up this book, and it was getting longer and longer and longer because there's so much to share. And having been to almost every single place that's in the book, there's only a few places. There's other places we have to explore yet, but I remember telling Deacon Dominic, I have to stop because this book is going to be 800 pages long because there's so much to share, because the history is that rich and there are so many different shrines and different just things to see in nature and in architecture, in history. It's mind-blowing. It truly is mind-blowing. And I always say in the book, God is showing off in Italy, because he just said, looky what I can do. I'm God, and I'm going to give you all these great artists and all this great beauty over the centuries. I'm going to put it in one country that's a little bit bigger than Florida, and we'll see how you do with that. It's phenomenal. Anywhere you go in Italy, it's just jaw-droppingly beautiful.
One of the things that you do that I think is very important is you have organized the book regionally, that you take certain regions. And when people tell me that they're going to go to Italy for 8 days and see the whole country.
Yeah, good luck with that.
Yeah, no, you can't.
Yeah.
Italy is something that is so rich that you need to pick a region, say, I'm just going to go to this area and, you know, imbibe all that is in that one area of Italy, because you can't do it all. You can't do Rome in 8 days.
No.
You can't.
No.
You have to live there to really know Rome.
And I actually say in the first part of the book, which is Lazio, which of course is where Rome is based, Rome wasn't built in a day, and so therefore don't expect to see it in a week, 2 weeks, even 3 weeks. Mm-mm. And I also have an Italy consultation company, Tease Italy, and when I do consultations, people say the same thing. We're going for 8 days. We're going to do Rome, Florence, Venice, then we're going down to the Amalfi Coast. And I guess physically, if you had a car or hired a driver, maybe you could do that, but you're going to be going from place to place to place, and you're not going to remember anything. Everything will be a blur because you haven't taken the time for la dolce far niente, the sweetness of doing nothing and slowing down. And I tell people, one tour a day. If you're going to Rome, go see the Vatican one day. Go to the Vatican Museums and St. Peter's. That's it. Because once you walk through, you know, the Gallery of the Maps, and you get into the Sistine Chapel, and you see everything and you're absorbing it, and then you go into St. Peter's and you see the Pietà and the Baldacchino and, you know, so many the tombs there, everything in the church, it's so, for a Catholic, it's overwhelming two ways. First of all, obviously the beauty, the detail, the architecture and the art, but secondly, the faith and the history of the church is explained to you. Mm-hmm. And so you're trying to comprehend this. And if you don't sit down and literally take a day off, it's not, you're not going to be able to absorb it, and everything, it's just too much. It's information overload. But you need that time spiritually to reflect on what you just saw.
That's,
you can't just walk through and look at the hand, you know, Adam in the hand of God reaching out, and then just walk away from it and say, okay, let's go on to the next thing on my bucket list. Italy is not meant to be done that way.
No.
You know, it's meant to be savored.
In fact, I would say no piece of art that is truly beautiful is meant to say, oh, I walked up and I saw the Mona Lisa. Mm-hmm. I saw the Last Supper. I saw
the David. I saw whatever. Yeah.
That's not that. No, you have to sit there and savor and take in. Mm-hmm. When you think of the detail that went into things, and some of the great stories of the art, like with Michelangelo with the Moses, when he took his chisel and hid it and said, speak. Mm-hmm. You know, it was almost alive. It's the artwork is so beautiful. To understand why the artist would say that, you need to stay there with the Moses. And again, if you're staying in Rome, I've had to be there for work, you know, to do programs. I'll go back to St. Peter's again and again.
And there's something you see the second time, the third time, the fourth time that you didn't see before.
Exactly.
Right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
And this is something that I think to have a sense that you also want to learn about some of the individuals, not just see another church. Mm-hmm. Sometimes you'll see exaggerations of tourism. Well, I saw five churches today and things like that. Do you know who those saints were? And to consider the way they changed their society, what they did. And it takes time to read about it. Now, you have some of that material here to help us understand these saints and meditate on who they are and seek their intercession as well.
Yep, and I think, too, when you get to know the regions and the saints, you understand how they were formed, you know, how they were formed and how they became with a certain way of prayer. For example, if you go to Norcia, the birthplace of St. Benedict and St. Scholastica, right? And then he goes down to Rome, and he thinks Rome is too busy and too noisy, so then he goes further south to Lazio, to the area of Monte Cassino, right? And then his sister follows him, and there's that beautiful story of the night she dies and that whole story about the storm. But the where they grew up or where they were born in Norcia is a beautiful area. It was affected by the earthquake a few years ago, but it's such a beautiful area of Umbria, you know, east of Assisi. And so you get the sense of, okay, they were born in this incredibly gorgeous place, and he was always surrounded by silence, right? And he had this opportunity to pray a particular way and come up with his rule. He goes down to Rome, goes down to Monte Cassino. But you learn about them when you understand the areas and why maybe they have a certain way of life, a prayer life. And you get to know them. And it's so interesting because we live in the region of Umbria, which is an interesting story behind that because we're not from that area. Our families are from the south. And we've gotten to know the saints quite well. And I've become even more and more fond of St. Francis of Assisi. We're about a half hour south of Assisi where we live, learning so much more about him as a deacon, because I'm a deacon's wife, right? He was a deacon. And just to, why he loved creation so much. But everything that Francis did was not because he was an environmentalist. I guess you could say in his time he was in some way because he loved creation. But everything Francis did, all was ordered to God and for people to know Christ better through creation. And so when you're there and you go to Assisi or you go up to Liverna in Tuscany where he received the stigmata, or you go down to Lazio for Greccio, the scene of the first crash, right, the live crash.
Yeah,
everything that he did was always in the middle of nature. And there was that peace involved. And then, that's why this is what happened, and this is his life of prayer, and this is why he did this, or this particular habit that he had. It makes sense.
Yes.
And you can connect the dots, and you can learn about their life more if you have a favorite saint from Italy, like a Catherine of Siena, or a St. Francis, or a St. Clair. The areas where they were from were very formative for them. And mm-hmm. that's why I wanted to describe it so much in the book.
Yeah. And this sense of knowing the place and knowing more about the saints mm-hmm. Isn't just about learning Italy. When you, for instance, you mentioned St. Benedict, mm-hmm. the history of Europe would not
be the same without him. Right.
Mm-hmm. There are a lot of cities throughout Western Europe in particular, in Germany and France and other countries, that were founded around Benedictine monasteries.
Exactly.
Munich is named, in its Latin name, as Monachium Monastery.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's Salzburg has the monastery mm-hmm. still up there in the center of town. They formed Europe. And to get a flavor of what that meant in his time and to read their history and understand it, this is very crucial.
And that's what I tried to do in the book. Obviously, you just can't fill one book with Italy. I could write another 20 books and just scratch the surface because of the history and whatnot. But I wanted it to be a book where anyone could pick it up, especially the faithful, obviously, but anyone interested in Italy. I mean, the cover is beautiful. The picture we chose, the Madonna della Corona, which is up along Lake Garda, is an actual monastery built on the side of a mountain, which is just phenomenally beautiful. But I wanted people to walk in the lives of the saints, to walk in the lives of the people, to hear personal stories, because most guidebooks, even though they're very good, and I did a lot of research before I did this book, and having traveling to Italy so much, I would buy a lot of guidebooks and combine it with research on the internet, of course. And most of them were very, as I said, informative, but they just had pages and pages of do this, do that, but there were no pictures, there were no recipes, there were no stories of the people. And half of the experience of being in Italy and going on a pilgrimage is meeting the people of Italy, going to someone's kitchen and having them prepare a meal for you. Even when we're with a group of 40 people, you can go to a place where they'll make the pasta with you and they'll teach you that. Or you can spend a day and maybe in a winery and get to know the owners and the family history, or make the olive oil. Learn about the culture and the food And as opposed to just going to, you know, Venice, Florence, Assisi, Rome, Venice, not that that's bad, right? It's all good. But take the time to learn from the people. What about the traditions? What about the festivals? I mean, I have a whole section. Every section has signature dishes and festivals, a festival from each region. And so how do they celebrate life? And 9 times out of 10, it's based on a saint.
Yep.
And yet it's a huge attraction because these festivals are so grand, depending on where you are, whether it's Assisi, whether it's Gubbio, whether it's, you know, Viterbo, wherever. It's all built on something related to Catholicism. And yet it attracts people from all over the world and all over Europe to these very, you know, amazing festivals with food and all kinds of fireworks and different things that they do. All goes back to the church and all goes back to God.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's something that you can really participate in. You know, being, you know, at, I was in a city during the Corpus Christi procession.
Which town were you in for that? Do you remember? Was it Orvieto?
Orvieto.
Yeah. Which is the Corpus Christi miracles in,
yeah,
in the cathedral.
Exactly.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And it's just a stunning procession.
It's crazy. Gorgeous. Beautiful.
Yeah. And you become part of it. And by just being there with the procession, observing the costuming,
right,
and all that, but also enjoying the prayer as the procession
and the
of the Blessed Sacrament
they often bring
goes
them,
right,
yep,
by.
Mm-hmm, yep, mm-hmm.
You know, this is absolutely stunning kind of experience. And you are praying your way. Mm-hmm. Now, this is one of the things that was a very important theme for me leading so many pilgrimages to the Holy Land. I always wanted our pilgrims to be pilgrims and not tourists.
Right.
That a tourist goes there, takes pictures, stands with a selfie, and then moves on. A pilgrim has a destination.
Mm-hmm.
And there's something they're seeking at that place spiritually. And you find it only by praying.
Right.
Does that also come into play in your pilgrimages?
Absolutely. And I was telling you behind the scenes before we started the show that on our last trip in October, we had 3 people come up to me and Deacon Dom privately and say they were coming back to the church because of the experience. And I think it is, we really try to embody, as what I love about the Catholic Church is that, you know, obviously the incarnation, the body, male and female, it's very important who we are and made in the image and likeness of God, the Imago Dei. But we're not just spirits flying around, right? And so what God made is good. This country of Italy, you know, all the world is beautiful. And it's okay to enjoy it, obviously in moderation. So we combine faith, fellowship, and fun. We have wonderful holy priests that come with us. We have mass every day. We say the rosary on the bus. We share our testimony. The priest will share his, you know, vocation story. And then we'll tell funny stories. I'll talk about growing up in an Italian-American family. Dominic and I'll take them to our favorite gelato shop or our favorite restaurant or the so-and-so that we know now because we've been going there for so many decades. And we laugh and we have fun and we take them for all kinds of different experiences. And so it's a combination of that. It's a combination of the spiritual. And even, for example, we see in Scripture, Jesus is at the wedding of Cana. I am pretty sure, even though it's not in Scripture, I mean, you're the Scripture scholar, that he probably danced and had a little wine, right? I mean, in moderation, right? He was there at this big festival. And I know from all my trips to the Holy Land, those weddings were not just a couple hours. They lasted for several days, right?
Yeah,
so
exactly.
There's a sense in Italy of they don't live to work, they work to live. Life is very important. La Familia, the celebrations, mm-hmm. even though the modern world in many of the big cities, such as Milan and Florence and Rome, you see the people just like here on the cell phones. But boy, when it comes to pranzo or cena, lunch or dinner, they're sitting down and that meal is important. The festivals are still important. That feeling of family and being together. And that we carry that over onto the bus. But spiritual, absolutely. But we don't hit people over the head with it. We let the beauty and God be our guide. Because when you're having mass in St. Peter's, or you're having mass in the Chapel of the Eucharistic Miracle in Orvieto, or if you're having mass where Padre Pio lived and worked and healed people left and right, you don't have to do too much work because God is showing up big time. And the responses of people, the life-changing experiences, is one of the reasons I wrote the book, to pick up on what we're doing on pilgrimage. My husband and I have been spending more and more time leading people on trips because we know the transformative experience that it can be. Life-changing. Life-changing. Yes. And we see it every trip, every single pilgrimage. Last time we had three. I mean, and the women's pilgrimage I do with my friend Kelly Walquist from Women in the New Evangelization, same thing. We have a women's pilgrimage, and women are together, and we're sharing reverts, converts, every single time.
Yeah. But something that you just mentioned, you know, the lunch and the dinner, the eating meals, is very important
Italy.
And it really is fun. And,
right.
And at some of the restaurants, you even get to sing.
Oh, we have musicians that come on our dinners.
Yeah. It's normal. But what you do here that I haven't seen in most groups or books about travel is that you include some of the recipes.
Yes, I did.
So you want people to they can't cook while they're on the trip.
They can cook when they come home. Yeah, they could cook when they can get cooking class, or they can they can learn how to cook. All kinds of cooking classes are offered in Italy across the country, or they can take these recipes and do them in their home. So it's I want you to taste it, smell it, breathe it, pray it, Italy.
Yeah.
Encompass it all.
Yeah, that's pretty cool. The one advantage of eating in Italy is there is a certain freshness to the food that I don't find in many places.
No.
You really, it's remarkable that the herbs and everything seem more fresh
so
than in most places.
So interesting you say that, because I remember when we first moved into our little place in Umbria, and we would go to the market, and they do have a fresh market in every town. They have different days, and ours is on a Monday. But then we also go to the grocery store, make our usual chicken health, try to eat healthy, whatnot. And I remember just cooking some chicken and some vegetables, and the chicken tasted so much better in Italy than it did here. And I guess it's because of the way they feed the different animals. They don't, they're not, you know, pumped up with all kinds of whatever. The food over there is so fresh, and the laws are very different. And it's interesting that RFK Jr. is talking about this now, as a new health secretary, because I noticed that when I started traveling, and a lot of our pilgrims who would be gluten-free here in America, they go over to Italy, they have no problem with the pasta. None.
Yeah.
Because of the way the process, the flour is processed, and the things that they use in the ingredients. It's very fresh. Everything is usually farm to table. And the pasta dishes are not sitting around for hours. They're made to order. Mm-hmm. And so they're making it fresh. And the tomatoes, because of the volcanic soil, also taste different in Italy. They're much richer. Because, you know, as an Italian-American, I never ate sauce from a jar. You'd be excommunicated, cut out of the will. You just don't do that in an Italian family, right?
Yeah.
And so I thought, okay, the food will be good, but I grew up with really good Italian food and learned how to cook it at a very young age. First time we had our first pasta in Rome, it was far better than my grandmother's. Sorry, Grandma Paolina. But amazing. Amazing taste, as you said. The flavors were popping, the basil, the tomatoes, the garlic. It was just incredible.
Yeah. And again, it's a combination, not only being fresh, you can find fresh, but it's also the kind of soil it's grown in.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, they also have a lot of these, as we call them today, heirloom seeds. They're, you know, long strains, though tomatoes, of course, don't come from Italy.
No, I know that.
It's an American.
Yeah, right. Mm-hmm.
But they sure did some great stuff with the tomatoes.
Well, there's a certain area around Naples that is known for its tomatoes, and they sell the product. I can't remember the name of the product, but they sell the products in the stores here, and it's a very good tomato to get if you're going to make your homemade tomato sauce from the, you know, if you buy the tomatoes in the can. But there's a certain area around Pompeii and Sorrento, and obviously right by the volcano, right, Mount Vesuvius, where the vegetables there and the tomatoes are very, very
is
good.
Is it the San Marzano?
San Marzano, yes.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah.
Excellent.
Those San Marzano tomatoes are extra good. But again, it's part of the soil. Different parts
and
of the world.
And the fresh ingredients, the fresh rosemary, the fresh basil, the olive oil is made locally. It's very, very good food.
But it's kind of cool that you included, you know, the recipes in here as well.
Because people want to take, when you go to Italy, you do want to take it home because the experience is so wonderful. Mm-hmm. You want to have that same, you want to relive that. And so these recipes are very easy. It's not going to take you hours. And as a matter of fact, where I went in the Sicily section, I have my holy cannoli recipe. came from my grandma, my father's mother, even though we're not Sicilian, we're from there. His family is from Calabria, so very close to Sicily. So in southern Italy, the cannolis are very popular. And I used to make, along with my grandmother, my aunts, the cannoli shells. Mamma mia, that's a pain. It takes a really long time. If you have the time, great, but you don't need to. You can go to a good market and get good cannoli shells. It's important, how do you fill the cannoli? How do you make the ricotta mixture? And so I have fun with that and say, look, you don't have to slave hours. You can still make a good meal and impress people. And the first recipe in the book is from the region we now live in, Umbria, the tagliare, or the cut. And it's your Italian version of what we'd call a charcuterie board. But when you're in Umbria, as you know, being a hunter and a lover of meat, the meats in Umbria, especially the boar, and of course the salami and the other types of processed meat, especially in Norcia, which is known for its meats.
Exactly.
So the cutting board is going to be very different. Each region is going to have its different meats. And so I show them how to put together a typical board, you know, from our region, Umbria, which is known for its meats. And then we can go to, for example, I tell them how to make, Joan Lewis has her limoncello recipe in the book.
Yes.
Right,
oh,
which
nice.
Is famous.
Yes.
So that would be from the Amalfi Coast, limoncello. So I really try, and there she is, beautiful Joan, your picture. I really try to give a flavor of Italy in more ways than one. And I wanted to give them a recipe so they could be in Rome if they're not going, or if they do go, to take it home with them.
Yeah. We have to take a little break.
Okay.
You know, this works in the media. But we will be back. Want to get some of your questions and your comments, so please stay with us. Before we get to your questions and comments, I want to mention that our own Father Miguel Marie is leading a Jubilee Year pilgrimage to the shrines of Italy and the Amalfi Coast. So Father Miguel will be with him. The dates are September 21st to October 3rd, and they will include Assisi, San Giovanni Rotondo, Naples and Rome, and a couple other places. So if you're interested in going on that trip, you can get more information by calling 256-347-1475. 256-347-1475. And if you go with him, you might want to get a copy of Teresa's book. Her book is called Italy's Shrines and Wonders, Discovering Sacred Spaces, Fascinating Places, and Destinations Off the Beaten Path. It's by Teresa Tomio. It's item number 84259. 84259. And you can get it at EWTNRC.com, our religious catalog, EWTNRC.com. You ready for some questions?
Sure.
Let's start off with Mike in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania.
My husband's home state.
Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
There you go. Mike, what you got for us today?
Yes, good evening, Ms. Tomeo and Father Mitch. Hey, how do you explain in a convincing way the miracle of the Holy House of Loreto, where in about 1291, angels transported the cell of the Blessed Mother to Loreto, Italy, to an atheist, a nominal Christian, or a believing Catholic in today's 21st century?
You want to take a stab at it, or you want me to?
Yeah,
you go ahead, and then I'll comment afterwards.
Mike,
it's a great question, though.
Yeah, it is a great question. There's something of a bit of confusion that goes on. There was a Crusader family.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And these Crusaders were in the Holy Land, and their last name was
Angeli.
Mm-hmm. Their last name meant
angels.
And these angels brought it over, and this is not something that people were hiding.
No.
Nobody was trying to make up a story, but when it said that the family of angels, La Familia de Angeli, brought this whole home over, it's not that an angel flew it over, it was this family of crusaders that brought it in. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting, I haven't looked carefully at the studies of this, but I was told that the limestone...
Yes, that's what I was going to say.
Yeah, yeah, the limestone mm-hmm. of the house of Loretto comes from Nazareth. There mm-hmm. is a trace metal in limestone, strontium. And strontium in limestone acts like fingerprints in a human being. Each one is unique, mm-hmm. a unique amount of strontium. And for instance, the limestone dust that was found embedded in the fibers of the Shroud of Turin.
I was just going to say that.
Is from
right,
the
exactly.
tomb of yeah. Jesus.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It's exactly from that tomb.
Yeah.
That's 100%. In fact, an archaeologist who was an atheist not only discovered that, but she was converted to Catholicism and ended up becoming a nun.
Right.
That's also the case with the House of Loretto. It's the traces of strontium show that it is from Nazareth. And it was brought over by the Angeli family.
Right.
I don't know if you're still there, but I hope that... Are you there?
Yeah, I'm here. Can you hear me?
Yeah,
yes,
yeah, I hear you. So does that clarify
yeah,
for
yeah.
you?
Yeah, that sounds like something to be very plausible to today's audience.
Well,
it's not a matter of being plausible.
Yeah.
It's what happened.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, and I don't think it makes it any less important from a faith perspective.
Right.
And I think for someone who's an atheist and agnostic, or even the 21st century, there's an old saying, according to our faith, to those who believe, no proof is necessary. To those who don't believe, no proof is enough. And I think it has to be a matter of faith at some point. And to me, it's miraculous, given the time period, that they made the effort to do that and were able to do it.
Yeah.
And there's so many healings connected with Loretto. Or what about the other miracles? What about the Eucharistic miracle of Lanciano, or the Eucharistic miracle in Siena, or the Eucharistic miracle in Cascia? You know, those are the places, too, that people, you bring them there, and it's like, Jesus, come and see. You can't force someone to believe.
Right.
You have to say, look, these are the facts, and as you so eloquently explained it. Now, think about that. Someone who had so much of a love of the faith and the Blessed Mother, when so concerned about preserving this piece of Christianity, wanted to keep it safe and so made the effort to bring it all the way over and keep it here in Italy for the faithful. That, to me, is an incredible miracle of faith, that it still stands there today as a place that we could go, which actually, and I know you know this, is one of the most popular pilgrimage sites in all of Europe, even in Italy. Next
yeah.
to St. Peter's, next to Rome, mm-hmm. is the House of Loretto.
Yeah. So it's a cool place, but the records of the Angeli
family
being,
right.
yeah, that's,
yeah,
that's all.
But also the way stories are handed down over generations, and sometimes, you know, fabricated, a little bit of this, a little bit of that, you know, so.
It's all clear. We have another caller, Thomas in Kingsport, Tennessee. Thomas, what you got for us?
How you doing, Father?
Fine, thank you, sir.
Well, I have a comment for you and Ms. Tomeo. My wife was born and raised in Puglia.
Oh, love Puglia.
She was, yes, she is. Her house was 30 minutes from San Giovanni Rotondo, which is not far from Bari, where the bones of St. Nicholas are, right in the church in downtown Bari. But I was just going to mention, and Teresa just mentioned this, that one of my favorite places to go is off the beaten path in Lanciano, Italy, where the 8th century Brazilian monk had a challenge with transubstantiation, mm-hmm. and the Eucharist turned into heart muscle, and the wine, of course, turned into blood. Yeah, so you might want to expand on that.
Well, I explain that in the book, and I have many of the Eucharistic miracles in the book, and to me, that is one of the most amazing experiences, because you can go literally right up to it, and you can see it, and I can remember pilgrims, and we had, this is about 10 years ago on one of our trips, we had several doctors, including a heart surgeon, on our trip, and they could not get over what they were seeing. And then you go downstairs in that church, and there's a display that was actually put together. It's not the actual one, but it's some of the work that was collected by Carlo Acutis. Remember all the work he did for mm-hmm. collecting on Eucharistic miracles? And there's a whole like little mini museum downstairs in that church, and they explain everything and how they took it for testing to some of the most well-educated medical experts on blood and heart muscle and these cardiologists. They didn't know what they were looking at, okay? They knew they were looking at what they thought was just heart muscle. They had no idea where it came from and how they tested it and what they found, that it was actually alive, basically, if I had the best way to explain it. So it's really incredible in terms of, when you're in this area, you just pull off the road and you go into this church and you think about this amazing Eucharistic miracle, or, of course, the corporal in Orvieto. So, but Puglia is another area. You talk about Bari and St. Nicholas, but Puglia is a very faithful area of Italy. And of course, you have the influence of Padre Pio there, who was originally from Campania, was not born in Puglia, but worked there the rest of his life. That's an amazing region. I love Puglia. It's one of my favorite places to visit. Fabulous.
Yeah. And the reason that St. Nicholas is in Bari was similar to the issue of bringing the House of Loreto to Italy. It was a way to avoid it being destroyed. There's a strong element of iconoclasm in Islam, the Holy Land being under Muslim rule since the 630s AD. And that iconoclasm even applies to Muslim places. Mm-hmm. Back in the 1700s, the tomb of Muhammad was destroyed because they didn't want any tombs with anybody's bones being visited. Mm-hmm. A certain sect of Muslims did that. And concern that such would happen to different saints led the Italians to bring them to Italy, not always with permission, but they they did do that.
Ask questions later, like that old saying. Yeah.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, but that's how St. Nicholas got to Bari, Italy. Mm-hmm. Had been in Myra, and then St. Mark was brought from Alexandria to
St.
Venice.
Andrew, who's in Amalfi, right?
Yep. Mm-hmm. Yep. So all these different things. Yep. We have another call. I have Steve from Oregon on. Steve, what can we do for you?
Yes, I got a question. In Italy, how many saints that are incorrupt, are they laid up in the churches? They have incorrupted, their bodies are incorrupt.
I'm not sure how many incorrupt saints they have. Carlo Acutis looks to be incorrupt, the way they have him preserved, but he's not. You have St. Catherine of Siena's head that you can still see, but it has been affected by time. Mm-hmm. I'd have to look that up. I'm not sure how many incorruptible
saints. Especially
seeing
as how she's been, she died almost 700
years ago. But you can still see her head there and her thumb in Siena, and then her torso is in, of course, Santa Maria Sopra Minerva in Rome.
And then, of course, you can see St. John the 23rd.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
He looks like he's just lying down asleep.
Right.
He's in a glass coffin. Mm-hmm. And then there's also St. Clair.
Right, St. Clair of Assisi. But the way they preserve the bodies, and they've changed that over time. Like, for example, when you go see Carlo Acutis in St. Mary Major in Assisi, it looks like an incorruptible body, but it's the treatment that they give, the relics covering the body with the wax and very realistic mm-hmm. appearances. So, but I'm not sure how many incorruptibles. There aren't that many incorruptible saints in general.
No, about 160 or so that we know of. If you go to Poland, you've got St. Andrzej Bobula.
Right, but then you also have St. Bernadette, of course, is in France. So,
and St. Catherine mm-hmm. Labouré.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's just mm-hmm. it's remarkable.
Yeah.
You know, they're quite beautiful.
And right.
It looked like they're peacefully taking
yes.
a nap.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But in Italy, I don't know how many there are, but there's some scattered throughout.
Sure, scattered throughout, but there's some in Umbria alone, for example, there's 35 saints, at least 35 saints just in that one region.
Yeah.
And Umbria is not that large. It's in central Italy, north of Lazio. Mm-hmm. And you can go to all of their tombs, and many of the relics are there for you to venerate, right, in the open, in reliquaries, of course, but you can see them.
We have another caller. Morgan is calling from Illinois. Morgan, what can we do for you?
Yes, good evening. The statue of St. Peter in St. Peter's Basilica, the large one, I have heard some Protestants claim that was originally a statue of Jupiter, one of the Roman gods, and the Christians repurposed it to be St. Peter. Now, if that's not true, who created the statue of St. Peter?
I had not heard that story before.
No. I, you know, there are...
Is he talking about the statue? Morgan, are you talking about the statue in St. Peter's Square?
No. The one in the Basilica where the people kiss the toes.
Okay, that's the one that we just saw up on the screen. That when you walk into the Basilica along the main aisle, you go up to the right and you can rub the foot of St. Peter.
Yeah.
I don't see how that could pop as... I have never heard that before.
No, and... When you look at it, it is clearly St. Peter.
Right. Yeah.
The papal insignia are on the statue,
right.
And Morgan, I'm afraid they're making that up out of whole cloth. I was recently in Washington, D.C. to do a number of program spots. Mm-hmm. And I went to the Basilica of the Immaculate Conception.
Mm, beautiful, yeah.
And in the crypt chapel, you have the last papal tiara that was worn mm-hmm. by Pope St. Paul VI. Mm-hmm. And there is a woman back in the 1840s, Ellen Gould White, who said that on the papal tiara is written the words, Vicarius Filii Dei. And she further claimed that if you took the Roman numerals in that title, which means Vicar, the Son of God, that the Roman numerals add up to what number?
666.
Yeah.
Yeah, right.
So what I did when I was in Washington is, with a camera, I walked all around. We'll show it on the network eventually. But walked all around the tiara. You know what was written on the tiara? Hmm. Nothing. There's nothing written on it. She made that up. And besides, the Pope's title is Vicar of Christ.
Mm-hmm.
It's not Vicarius Filii Dei.
See, that's why it's important to go to Italy and to have a good, solid guide, to have a Catholic guide. That's the other thing that we do, and I know that you do when you do pilgrimages, and anyone through EWTN or any of our affiliates, mm-hmm. if we're organizing a pilgrimage, we're doing it with solid Catholic guides.
Yep.
Because you could get someone who is not a faithful person and just treats it as another building. But if you have someone who knows their faith and the history, such as, for example, my favorite guide in all of Rome is Dr. Liz Lev. I think she's amazing.
Mm-hmm.
And she's a solid Catholic, but she's giving you the Catholic history. And then she's going back to the artist and explaining the artist, why was the artist commissioned in the first place? And what did the artist have in mind when he was doing this particular sculpture? And people they hear things, they see things, and it's important for Catholics, even if they can't get there, a book like this gives you the history. Like, for example, I was telling you during the break that one of the things I've learned, having been to Orvieto so many times now, is that when you go to the beautiful Duomo, and you have, on the left side, you have the Chapel of the Corporal, where the Eucharistic miracle is kept. On the right-hand side, you have the Chapel of San Fabrizio, which is famous for its amazing frescoes of heaven and hell, the last judgment, the apocalypse, and also there's a very eerie scene of, it's called the Antichrist. And so you see the devil speaking through this image. It looks like a Christ, but it's obviously not because the skin is very, it's got a contorted look on the face.
It's Christ off.
Right. Yeah. But it's fascinating, and you learn when you go there that Michelangelo spent 3 months in Orvieto studying those paintings in that chapel before he went down to Rome to paint the Sistine Chapel. And there are many that consider Signorelli just as good, if not, depending on the historian you're talking to, just as talented as Michelangelo. Mm-hmm. But it's really important to do your homework and to understand that, you know, God bless that person who was telling Morgan that story. They may have heard it from someone, but that's completely fictional. And all the times I've been to Italy, and every tour I've done, I've been to St. Peter's probably 150 times. I've never heard anything about that statue.
Of course, no.
Never.
It's just,
yeah.
I've seen representation of that old statue of Jupiter from the Capitoline Temple. Mm-hmm. It doesn't look anything like that. Right. And by the way, I also, when I went and did that little spot, I mentioned that if you take the Roman numerals of the name Ellen Gould White, they do add up to 666. You don't want to play these games.
No.
You know, this is something that you stay clear of. And some people need to make Catholicism of a form of the revival of
idol worship,
paganism.
Idol worship. That's what we do. We worship idols.
And that's not what's there.
Right.
It's rather devotion to Peter, the rock of the church.
Well, the other thing, too, that, and I think, you know, and again, God bless Morgan's friend, whomever that was, but when you have what you have in the faith in the way the churches were designed, is people didn't have a Bible. They couldn't go to the local Catholic bookstore and buy a Bible because most of the people, right, were illiterate. And even after the printing press, it wasn't something that you, I could pick it up and buy it. It wasn't available readily to the average person. Mm. So when they went to church, those who were designing these amazing basilicas, they were giving their catechesis by the structures.
Yeah.
When you walk up to the Duomo of Orvieto, and you see on the one side the Old Testament and the other side the New Testament, but there's a very significant difference between the people who are living their lives according to God because they're in heaven, and then the bottom you see hell. You also see the life of Christ, you see the life of Mary, and this is just on the facade before you even walk in. So they're walking in to receive the Eucharist, to celebrate Mass, and they're understanding from the visuals of, I better pay attention here because if I don't, there's something's going to happen. Then you go inside the church, and then you see, you know, the statues, and then you see the stained glass windows. And so everything is explained in visuals because they didn't have the printed word available to them.
They didn't have printing.
Right.
So a copy of the Bible used to cost $200,000 in our money. Again, I want to remind people, your book is called Italy's Shrines and Wonders, Discovering Sacred Spaces, Fascinating Places, and Destinations Off the Beaten Path by Teresa Tomeo. It is item number 84259 over at EWTNRC.com. And to find out when Teresa's going on these trips, go to TeresaTomeo.com. And Teresa is just T-E, not T-H.
That's right, so after Teresa Bavala.
Yes, so TeresaTomeo.com. What does this trip usually cost?
It depends, and usually it's several thousand dollars a person, but everything's included, so that's what really is great. Yeah.
Okay.
And then also we have a trip for women coming up in the fall in October that's still open. Our couples trip is sold out, but we do have a wonderful pilgrimage for women in the fall. Yeah.
Well, thank you for being
with
us.
Yep.
And may the Lord bless all of you and keep you, the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit. Amen. And we can bring you Teresa not only with this show and her other shows, but all the other programs we have only because this network is brought to you by you. So please remember to keep us in between your gas bill, your electric bill, and your cable bill. If you do that, we'll be able to pay all of our bills too. This is how our Lord inspired Mother Angelica to found and keep this network going. And we still love the way our Lord uses you so we can evangelize the world. God bless you all, and thank you.
Thank you, Father.